Yesterday's bombing devastated an apartment building in the northern city of Burgos, where civil guardsmen were living with their families. The attacks come on the eve of the 50th anniversary of ETA's founding. On July 31, 1959, young radicals broke away from the main Basque independence movement, and in the late 60s they began a campaign of violence that has killed more than 800 people. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolovsky in Madrid.
U.S. stocks are gaining ground. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 132 points at last check at 9,203. The NASDAQ Composite Index up now 25 at 1992. S&P 500 up 16 at 992. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour, we'll continue with the China theme that we have going this morning with an archive program that we first broadcast a couple of weeks ago, a conversation with Jay Taylor about a recently published biography that he's written about Chiang Kai-shek. So this is a show that we first broadcast on the 8th, and do recall or keep in mind as you listen in this hour of the show, we'll not be taking calls. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the life of the nationalist Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek. At the time of his death, this was in 1975, Chiang Kai-shek was widely viewed as a brutal dictator, a failed military leader, and the man who lost the mainland to Mao Zedong. Our guest for the program today, Jay Taylor, the author of a new biography of the Chinese leader, says that that was once his assessment of Chiang Kai-shek as well. But in the process of writing this book, he says that he's now come to see Chiang as a very complex figure, certainly not the complete villain that many people in the West see, nor the saint long revered in Taiwan. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jay Taylor about his recently published book, The Generalissimo, the subtitle Chiang Kai-shek and the Struggle for Modern China. It's published by the Harvard University Press. Our guest, Jay Taylor, is research associate at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University. He's the author of a number of books, including a previous book that is a biography of the son of Chiang Kai-shek. He has contributed articles and op-eds on world affairs to the Washington Post, the LA Times, the New York Times. He also spent a number of years in the U.S. Foreign Service, among other things. He served as political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. He was White House NSC staff member for East Asia. He was officer in charge for Chinese affairs at the Department of State, and he received a number of awards for his work, the Director General's Award for Best Foreign Service Reporting and also two Superior Honor Awards. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Taylor, hello.
Hello, hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
You explain, I think, in the book that in the process of writing the book about Chiang Kai-shek's son, who succeeded him as the leader of Taiwan, that you started to think perhaps differently about Chiang himself, who he was. Talk a little bit about this new understanding that you feel perhaps you've gained and that would run counter to this image that I think so many people will have of him.
Well, that's right. When I started the book on the son, Chiang Jinghua, I pretty much had the standard view of Chiang Kai-shek, sort of a cardboard dictator, for 50 years. But in doing all my reading and research for the book on Chiang Jinghua, I came to see it was much more complicated than that. And then as I got into all the books and materials, mountains, Himalayas of materials, documents, diaries, what have you, on Chiang Kai-shek, then I began to see the man was had a very mixed record. And his achievements were historic. The man, after all, he was the leader of China during its most tumultuous period and during the greatest changes until Mao Zedong made communism and Deng Xiaoping undid it in China. He led China after the fall of the Qing dynasty when they had years of of division and civil wars. He led China for the first time to be united under one flag, although he still had warlords to contend with. And then for 10 years, during the Nanjing Decade, that is 1927 to 37, before the Japanese invaded, almost all scholars will still credit him that during that period of depression, very low trade, Manchuria had been seized by the Japanese. He was still fighting some of the warlords, and he was fighting the communists. Despite all this, there was considerable progress in all the social indices in terms of social development, in terms of economic development. But then the Japanese invaded. And then for 4 years, he led China virtually alone in the world, except for some military aid from the Soviet Union, cut off from the world with no foreign trade, no foreign aid, except some arms from the Soviet Union. For 4 years, he's kept the Chinese people united. He was ruling then about two-thirds of the people of China, and about three-quarters of the land of China was still under Free China. And so at the end of the war, he had, after the U.S., of course, the last 4 years of the war, he was allied with the United States. So by the end of the war, he had kept the Chinese people united under him. There were no major defections. He had ended the terrible unequal treaties all the powers had imposed on China. He had recovered all the lost territory, at least in principle and by treaties and agreement. And China, in 1945, at the end of the Cold War, it was destined to play its major role in the world, as Franklin Roosevelt and Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong all envisioned. Mm.
And
then
in fact,
the Civil War came along.
You come to this conclusion that I think might surprise some people. Certainly, I would think that most people would think that of any individual, the person that was most responsible for the character of modern China would be Mao Zedong. In fact, you make the argument that China today, as it is, it's much more in keeping with Chiang Kai-shek's vision than with Mao Zedong's.
Oh, I think that's really almost can be argued against. That if you look at China today, it is led by leaders that Chiang Kai-shek, if he could return, he would see them as the modern-day neo-Confucianists or Confucianists, that they are committed to seeing China recover its place in the world, to becoming a prosperous and a stable and a unified country again, with a position that ultimately will be unexcelled in the world. That is all of their objectives. Mm-hmm. But it also depends upon the industry and the entrepreneurial spirit of the Chinese people to create the economic base for this, and that is capitalism. And so it is essentially a capitalist, modern Confucian state. The Chinese regime today has resumed the focus on Confucianism as the, sort of the cultural and the social heart of the moral and ethical system that provides a framework, a non-political framework for Chinese society today. And so it's true. I think it's quite evident, really, if you go to China today. And it's a very controlled society. That's what Chiang Kai-shek wanted. He wanted a happy and an open society, but one that was controlled, where political activity was limited and was controlled. That's what he had in mind. And if you go to China today, you can see, I think, that the vision that drives modern China and its great impetus that it has today to becoming a great, resuming its role in the world, That vision is the vision of Chiang Kai-shek.
Our guest today in this hour of Focus 580 is Jay Taylor. He's a research associate at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University and is author of a recently published biography of Chiang Kai-shek. The title of his book is The Generalissimo, and it's published by the Harvard University Press, Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. The book's out now if you'd like to read it. Questions, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There are two things that I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about. These are two forces that, in the book, you argue were very important in shaping his identity in his formative years. One of them is Neo-Confucianism. What does that mean?
Well, Neo-Confucianism, as distinct from Confucianism, is notable for its emphasis on self-development, on a rigorous development of one's character, that China is to be ruled under that by these people, superior people, that can discipline themselves and become responsible for their own character development and conscious of this every day and in every action, detaching themselves from sort of the world to look at themselves in order to bring about a leader, a personality who has rectitude, who has commitment, and a sense of responsibility. And this rigorous self-development, that's the character of the main character of Neo-Confucianism, that's distinguishing it from the moral principles of Confucius.
The other thing, and this was something that you say he certainly would have shared with almost all of the other leaders of China in the 20th century, and I think this would be something that they would share regardless of their other kind of political ideologies, was their feelings about China and how it had suffered at the hands of Japan and the great powers of Europe.
That is certainly the major feature, I think, in all Chinese outlook on the world today and on China's position in the world. And that is the history that of humiliation at the hands of the foreign powers, including Japan and the Western countries. It was a record of rank humiliation and mortifying defeats, military defeats. China seemed helpless. It seemed to be a crippled giant that could not even rise up. And this feeling it led to a deep, deep sense of grievance, a deep sense that China had this mission. And the principal mission that China had, all Chinese had to assume, that superseded their own welfare and that of their family, was to recover China's greatness in the world. And that is what drove Mao Zedong, and it's what drove Chiang Kai-shek.
Is that what led him to decide that he wanted to pursue a military career?
Yes, definitely. He had a military career, an anti-foreign, anti-imperialist attitude since he was a very young man, sort of high school age. Then it became very early on, though, before he went to Japan for the first time to begin studies, eventually at a preparatory school for the military academy. Even before that, he had been converted by the nationalistic writings of the followers of Sun Yat-sen and other early Chinese nationalists. And he became not just an anti-foreign, an anti-imperialist individual committed to reviving China's greatness in the world, but he was committed to the principle that it had to become a republic and that the Qing dynasty, which was really a foreign dynasty, the Manchus, had ruled China for more than 200 years, that it also had to be replaced. So he became an anti-Qing, a modernizing Republican, an anti-imperialist young man. He cut off his queue. All Chinese, under the Manchus, all Chinese males had to wear a pigtail because the Manchus did. And this was a sign of submission to the Manchus. And so before he went to Japan, when he was 18 years old, he cut off his queue, which was considered by his family very dangerous and risky and terrible thing to do. And Mao Zedong, when he was 18, also cut off his queue. So Mao and Zhang have many similarities. But in the end, both of them were affected by a foreign ideology or religion. Zhang became a Christian, and Mao Zedong, of course, early on became a communist. Mm-hmm.
We have a caller to talk with. Why don't we do that? Our first, and this is someone who is listening in Champaign, and they are on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Would you, just for my own edification, describe his early days? I was thinking of the novel and the movie, The Sand Pebbles, which starts or set around the time of the Boxer Revolution. I don't know enough about Chinese history to know all about that, and so could you just describe the early days of his career, and then also and about that period, and then also could you contrast him with the man who is referred to by many as the American Caesar, Douglas MacArthur, which I'm sure he had some sort of colorful relationship with.
Yeah,
if you would
Right. Very good questions. Well, about the time of the Boxer Rebellion, he would have been 15 years old. So this was one of the episodes in China's history. It certainly made a huge mark on Zhang and people like Mao Zedong. The humiliation, one, of the rise of the Boxers, who were these very atavistic, backward, primitive, superstitious movement, and that the dynasty, the Empress Dowager, who was running China at the time, supported these this primitive group, fanatical, non-anti-modern group. They tore up railroads, as well as killing missionaries. They were anti-modern. So young Chinese like Zhang, even at that age, were highly distressed in two ways, that the Chinese government could actually support them. It was a sign of the degradation of what's happened under this Qing dynasty, but that the foreigners would so easily come in with small force and defeat the Boxers and the Chinese army, and then ravage China and then impose upon China a huge penalty, the Boxer indemnity. So that made a huge impression on him. He, as I say, he went on to Japan to military school, and then the revolution happened, the revolution against the dynasty in 1911. He came back and played a role in that revolutionary period, just lasted a few months, and then became an officer under Sun Yat-sen. And it came to Sun's attention eventually, went on different missions for Sun, played different roles in the revolution. And when Sun became president, then stepped down, then in favor of a big military man who was going to take over anyway. But anyway, had to have a second revolution. He played a big role in that. But finally, by 1925, when Sun Yat-sen died, Chiang Kai-shek was in a position to be among the top three possible successors to Sun Yat-sen. And within a year, by 1926, he was essentially the leader of the Kuomintang. Then, the second question was about General MacArthur. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think in many ways they were sort of alike, I think. Both of them were reserved, taciturn personalities. They were not warm individuals, not seen to have much of a sense of humor, but they were very dedicated and disciplined people. They had a goal, and whatever the goals were, they stuck with that. And they also had the sense of theater as leaders. Both of them always were on the stage in their own mind as well as in others' minds. They're right. There were quite a lot of similarities.
I'll invite other people to call in. You have questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest this morning is Jay Taylor. He's the author of a new biography of Chiang Kai-shek. The title of the book is The Generalissimo. I think it's interesting, perhaps ironic, given that he led the fight against the Japanese in World War II, that he, in fact, got his military training in Japan. He actually served in the Japanese army, I think, for a couple of years. What did he think about Japan and the Japanese?
Well, he loved Japan, and he greatly admired the Japanese society and culture, the discipline that the Japanese had, the efficiency that they had, they brought to everything, which was reflecting this sort of a neo-Confucianist outlook. And total commitment, total dedication to the mission. And when the mission, the greatest mission, was their patriotism. And whereas the Chinese, he saw, like Sun Yat-sen, were heaps of sand. Their problem, they could never unite. They didn't seem to have the strength to get together to oppose the foreign powers who could walk over China with a few hundred soldiers at almost any time. But so he liked this Japanese spirit, for example, the Bushido spirit of the samurai, that of fighting to the death. And when he led the military academy under Sun Yat-sen, and when the revolution, the second revolution, was going on, this is the spirit he tried to impose on the young cadets that would become the Chinese army officers. So he loved the Japanese, but by as early as 1926, he came to hate the Japanese government. and the system, the political system in Japan. This was a result of an incident that took place in Jinan in Shandong province when his troops came in to occupy it from the warlords. The Japanese were there to so-called protect their Japanese residents. And the Japanese had airplanes, tanks, artillery, and his forces had none of that. They were essentially like a medieval army or 19th century army. And the Japanese slaughtered the Chinese civilians and military alike. And Zhang pulled back. He knew he could not defeat the Japanese. And from that day on, 1926, he began to call the Japanese the dwarf pirates in his diaries. He always referred to them, not publicly, but in his diaries, as the dwarf pirates. And he did that until the end of the war. But he continued to admire a great deal about the Japanese society. And so when he came to Taiwan, it was very controversial among his generals and officers. He actually brought some of the Japanese generals and officers to Taiwan to help train the military forces that had escaped from the mainland to try to give them this Bushido spirit. So he had this mixture of hatred for Japan in some ways, but really a great love and admiration for it.
Well, I think, too, a key point is here that even before the Japanese invaded, he considered Japan to be a serious threat to China.
He did. That was for more than 10 years. In 1926, in his diaries, he makes clear Japan is the key enemy for the foreseeable future that threatens China's sovereignty and Chinese civilization. Eventually, he saw them the way they were trying to Japanize Korean society. They occupied Korea and Taiwan. They had occupied Taiwan since 1895. That was 10 years he saw. And although the common wisdom and history is up till recently was that Zhang did very little. He didn't see the Japanese threat. He was simply interested in retaining his power. But the things that he did to prepare for the war, he began immediately in 1927 bringing in German trainers and German arms and a huge program of exporting strategic minerals to Germany. This was in the Weimar Republic period, not the Hitlerian period, although it continued under Hitler, to try to modernize the Chinese army, shaping factories out of the coast, shaping the Palace Museum collections, 20,000 crates. He was preparing for the war, building the Burma Road. But the common wisdom is that he was doing nothing. Stilwell, General Joseph Stilwell, the general American general in China during the war, would say he did nothing. He was essentially hopeless, had made no contribution to fighting the Japanese. But he did a lot, and for 10 years he prepared for the day. And he kept putting it off, awaiting trying to build a modern society, trying to appease the Japanese until he thought, a strong force. And he could complete the unification of the country by putting down the warlord rebellions, which kept popping up, but also to liquidating the communists who were receiving substantial aid from the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. That's one thing we could mention, some of the new material that we have that shows the extent of Soviet aid to the Chinese Communist Party from 1927 on.
Well,
can I give you a good example of that?
Certainly, go ahead.
Everybody has heard of Mao Zedong's Long March from where they were controlling down in the province of Jiangxi province, and they had been there for quite a few years until 1934. They were surrounded by Chiang Kai-shek, and they decided, with Stalin told them it was time to move out and try to move up further north towards the Soviet border. And the Comintern, the Communist International, which was, of course, controlled by the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin, before Mao and his troops, his 20,000, sometimes his 800,000 troops, marched off to begin the Long March, the Comintern provided them 4 million Mexican silver dollars, the Mexican silver dollars being a rather common sort of hard currency used in China at the time. And they carried these out in huge trunks. And that's how they got, they've They bought food, and they bought their way through the warlord territories through this huge treasury that they had.
This is Focus 580, and our guest this morning is Jay Taylor. He is the author of a recently published biography of Chiang Kai-shek. The title of his book is The Generalissimo, Chiang Kai-shek and the Struggle for Modern China. It's published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, and our guest, Jay Taylor, is a research associate at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University, also someone who has spent a lot of time in the U.S. Foreign Service doing various sorts of things in Asia, was political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. He was White House NSC staff member for East Asia. He was officer in charge for Chinese affairs at Department of State. He's also the author of an earlier book that is about the son of Chiang Kai-shek. And that title is The Generalissimo Son. That was published by the Harvard University Press, came out in the year 2000. Something I'd like to just take maybe a little bit of a step back in time from the point that we are at this point in the conversation. He was involved. He became involved in the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, fairly early on in his history, became close to Sun Yat-sen, rose quite quickly in the leadership of the Kuomintang, and so he was positioned well to step into the leadership spot when Sun Yat-sen died. Can you talk a little bit more about his involvement in the Kuomintang and how it is that he seemingly fairly quickly became part of Sun Yat-sen's inner circle?
Well, I think he won Sun's respect and admiration by serving in various capacities, going on secret covert missions and involving some guerrilla activities, including assassinations of the what were then the warlord officials in Shanghai, for example. But also as a military tactical officer, he had been very successful and proved himself, but he was important in that all the supporters of Chiang Kai-shek, he was one of the few senior people as they rose up in the military during the revolutions, that he really had no military base. He had, unlike some of the others, had regional offices. They'd been military officers or governors who had essentially formed their own military forces during the revolution and then allied with Chiang Kai-shek. Allied with Sun Yat-sen. Mm-hmm. But Chiang Kai-shek did not have a military force of his own, and his loyalty was totally to Sun Yat-sen. So Sun had great respect for that, but also for Chiang's perseverance, his determination. But at the same time, despite his devotion and loyalty to the great leader, when he felt something was the leader had done something wrong, something major about this military strategy, or what, he would take exceptions. And sometimes he would resign and go back to his home in a village in Zhejiang province until he was called back. So this sense of rectitude that he exuded, this also appealed to Sun Yat-sen. And then Sun Yat-sen appointed him to be the head of the military academy for the Nationalist Kuomintang forces. And from that, of course, all the officers, the cadets and that graduated and became officers in the Nationalist Army and the Chinese Army afterwards, they all felt a loyalty to Chiang Kai-shek. But nevertheless, Chiang still had to deal with the warlord armies. So during even all the 8 years of war with the Japanese, he really only had full control of half or less than half of the Chinese armies. And so he had to cajole, he had to entreat, he had to plead with, but also sometimes threaten and try to play off warlords against one another to get them to do what he wanted them to do. So his record through this period until 1941, when the Pearl Harbor, after Pearl Harbor, the U.S. and China became allies, of course. His military and political record were really quite, I think, quite admirable for what he had done in those almost 20 years since he had taken over, 15 years. But during the Second World War, the system began to collapse internally. The corruption rose, inflation became more of a problem. But still, he held things together. It was still quite remarkable that inflation, considering what that they had no way of increasing local production for domestic consumer goods or any kind of goods. It was remarkable how low it was. But then after the war was over in 1945, the political, administrative, economic, financial situations all were a disaster. So he has to be given the responsibility for what was this collapse from 1946 until 1949. Then we moved to Taiwan. So the Taiwan period is something we should discuss, too.
Well, I tell you what, why don't we, I have a couple of people who are on hold here. Let's bring them into the conversation, and we'll do that as well. First, we'll go to someone here on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Well, thank you for taking the call. It's my view that Zheng and the warlords were not that much different in that their power rested on an army that was intact, and that you don't make great commitments of force that would diminish the power. So neither the warlords nor Zheng were very anxious to have full engagements and combat technologies that they didn't have. And I'd like you to comment on that. And the second point is that Zheng's retreat to the mountains in the south, although it connected him to the route over the Himalayas or the route supply route, was probably a disaster in that it didn't connect him to the rest of China, and Mao's propaganda about his being among the people, a fish in the sea, had greater power than survival in Nanjing.
Those are good points. I think it's not surprising that many people do believe that Chiang Kai-shek didn't want to commit his forces. This was the view propagated by, of course, General Stilwell during the war. Stilwell in China, right, in Barbara Tuchman's book. But I think you'll have to consider the record, and the historic record is quite plain, that Chiang Kai-shek did begin to try to develop a modern army with German arms and German training. And by the time of the Japanese attack in 1937, July 37, he had 300,000 trained German troops. 80,000 were both armed and trained. And when the war began, he threw all of those troops into the battle for Shanghai. If they could win the battle for Shanghai, he thought the Japanese would then agree to a treaty to pull back, and they would cease their invasion and give them the impetus then to begin demanding a return of Chinese territories like Manchuria. He committed all those forces, sir, and they were virtually wiped out. All of his forces, his only modern forces, but he contributed another 200,000 or 300,000, committed them to that battle. But as you say, the Japanese had the modern arms, they had modern aircraft. He had a few hundred old aircraft been trained by the Italians. He had no modern navy. He had only a few tanks. The artillery was old. Tanks that were pre-World War I tanks. But he threw them all into this battle. And that he felt if he had 6-1 overwhelming personnel odds, he could win. He lost Shanghai. He lost at least the majority of his best forces, his elite forces. They continued to fight the Japanese all the way up the Yangtze Valley, a fight that went on for more than a year before the Japanese were finally able to capture Wuhan, which is further up the Yangtze. To the surprise of many, the Nationalist Army were able to hold them off for all that period. The Japanese then occupied the main cities and the ports, and they could control the railways, because anything they wanted, any piece of territory they wanted, they could take with their modern army and complete control of the air, and they have 1,000 aircraft. And after the end of the Shanghai, essentially Chiang Kai-shek could rely upon the Soviets, who sent in a few hundred aircraft, and they did play an important, helpful role. But he committed his forces so that when Zhou Enlai sent a report, we have this document, that then we found in the archives of the Communist International. And Zhou Enlai gave a report, and it would have been in August that he wrote the report, in August of 1939. So it was 2 years after the war. And he reports that all the Chinese forces, of course the Communists and the Nationalists, were united then under a united front to fight the Japanese. And he said about 3 million Chinese had suffered 3 million casualties. And of those, he gave 30,000 were in the 8th Route Army, the Communist Army, and in the new 4th Army, the other Communist Army, had been, I don't know, 3 or 4,000. In other words, it was about 3%. This is a report by Zhou Enlai. The Nationalist forces, sir, suffered 97%, well over 90% of all the casualties. Another report to the Comintern from the Chinese Communist Party that's in the Moscow archives reports the casualties up to that time, again, over 90%. Maybe not 93%, not 90, only 3% for the Communists, maybe about 7% for the Communists. It was Mao Zedong whose policy was to avoid combat with the Japanese, except for one time. He became overconfident. He launched a campaign against the Japanese. The Japanese just swept them away and killed tens of thousands of civilians who were living in that area where the Communists had come in to try to fight the Japanese. And he never did again, never. Whereas Zhang continued to defend cities when the Japanese went on little offensives, big offensives, they lost again, probably another million or so. So the record is quite clear. Chiang Kai-shek did the fighting. Mao Zedong did very little except for one campaign.
The caller raises the name of General Joseph Stilwell. This was the guy who was sent by the United States to support the Chinese against the Japanese.
Right.
He apparently hated Chiang, and perhaps at least some of what we think we know, this image of Chiang Kai-shek as being incompetent, comes from Stilwell.
Right. I think you'll have to... Stilwell's, of course, book, Barbara Tuchman's book on Stilwell, is for most of the American view of the Stilwell-Zhang hostility. And hers was based almost entirely on Stilwell's diaries and his papers, to which he was given full access for the first time. It's very little Chinese sources, very little interviewing those around Chiang Kai-shek, virtually none. But if today we have the memoirs of many other hundreds of people, but also we have the diaries of Chiang Kai-shek, Zhang gave everything from his point of view. Stilwell gave everything from his point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But if you put them, you have to read them both to come out with any kind of an objective view, a hope for an objective view. And I think if you read my book, I think you'll see that an entirely different picture emerges of Stilwell and the Zhang problem.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have another caller we'll get right to. I'd also like to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in. We are talking with Jay Taylor. He's research associate at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University and is the author of a recently published biography of Chiang Kai-shek. The title of his book is The Generalissimo. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press.
Could I add one thing?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Sorry for jumping.
No, fine.
But something I should say in discussing Chiang Kai-shek and the fact that his achievements were, I think, quite historic, some on the mainland before the Civil War period of 46 to 49, but on Taiwan as well. But Chiang also was, I say, a mixed historic person. He committed acts that were extremely, some controversial acts, of course, any man in power for 50 years, but some that were atrocious, clearly atrocious acts, decisions that he's made, and some of them could certainly be considered crimes against humanity. They were so atrocious. So one could go back to even during the Second World War to stop the Japanese, slow them down. He blew up the dikes on the Yellow River. And this led to the loss of at least a million Chinese lives, a million Chinese drowned. It slowed the Japanese down. They couldn't take Zhengzhou there on the rail line between Beijing and Wuhan for another couple of years or more. Also, then in Manchuria, when he was clear he was going to lose Manchuria, he kept throwing more and more forces into the battle, and where he lost a few hundred thousand men. And at that point, he had begun to, he had been very pessimistic about defeating the Chinese in Manchuria because they had Soviet support. And he had been thinking of the retreat to Taiwan. And by that point, he began thinking it's going to be all or nothing. And he threw everything into Manchuria. And when it was clearly hopeless. And those lives that were lost, seemed to me, could be considered really a crime against humanity, although he was sending in his own men in a civil war. But then in 1947, we had the uprising in Taiwan, and the suppression of that killed maybe 28,000 Taiwanese. Like, the comparable thing would be in America if some kind of uprising and the army put down an uprising in America, and the population equivalent would be, 200,000 or 300,000 Americans killed. Then when he fled to Taiwan in 1949, he instituted a white terror, and 4,000 or 5,000 Taiwanese were executed in order to try to intimidate any kind of political dissidents in Taiwan. So that's a pretty atrocious record, and you have to compare that with his achievements, including the ultimate achievements in Taiwan.
All right, let's take another caller here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello?
Interesting comment on how the Allies managed to meet in, Cairo? How did they travel there? And any new insights on T.V. Sung, banks and railroads, and on Teddy White, one of the few reporters who understood the language? Thanks.
Well, Cairo, yes, they flew to Cairo in of course, American planes, but sometimes they flew an American Air Force, but this was a Chinese Air Force plane flown by Chinese and American aircraft. Cairo was very important for Zhang. Zhang saw it as a big success, and he and Roosevelt had agreed on everything. But the one thing they had agreed on was that the second campaign in Burma would involve a British amphibious landing. And after Zhang left Cairo, Churchill talked Roosevelt into canceling that because of the coming invasion of Europe, Normandy. And this infuriated Zhang, and he overplayed his hand there, and that created a real crisis, and also further hurt his reputation among the Americans. The second thing you mentioned was,
I'm afraid that I sort of lost the thread.
We lost the
caller, oh. and he has hung up. We're here in about our last 5 minutes or so. Let me, if you and he will forgive me, ask a little bit different question. I think that a lot of people will think of the big fight between within China between the right and the left, between the nationalists and the communists, as being something was really a post-war. Mostly a post-war phenomenon. And I think that one of the things you point out is that actually this goes back really before World War II, goes back to the late 20s when there was a purge of communists, and there were communists within the Kuomintang at this time. Now, they did manage to come back together later, sort of, to fight the Japanese.
Right.
But there was this long-running enmity, really, between the two going back to this point. What was behind Zheng's purge of the communists from the Kuomintang?
Well, as you say, there was a united front between the communists and the Kuomintang, and under this united front, the communists could join the Kuomintang. Chiang Kai-shek, when he was heading the military academy, preparing for the northern expedition to try to unite the country and defeat the warlords, he very much favored the communists, and even saw that they were having political officers like the Soviet Red Army, who were their advisors. He liked the concept of having these political officers who would retain loyalty and make sure there was loyalty among the commanding officers and that they were treating the people right and so on. And so his idea was that all these political officer should be communist. But anyway, the revolution, the Northern Expedition to start free the country started in 1926 under Zhao after Sun died. And the difference between Sun Yat-sen, between the communists and Chiang Kai-shek, just over that year, as he marched northward, became more and more serious. Zhang was accused, of course, trying to maintain power by making himself a dictator. I think the book points out that Zhang was doing, that may have been his objective, but he certainly wasn't a dictator and didn't have full control because most of his army, at that point, was still controlled by various warlords. And his central army, he controlled one corps out of about six or seven army corps. And so there was a lot of tension. And eventually the left Kuomintang, a left faction, sided with the communists and trying to bring Chiang Kai-shek's pressure for him to be ousted or to retire. At one point then he learned that they had issued an order for his arrest. So he then, there were also at the same time the general in Beijing, in charge of Beijing, the northern warlord, he seized the Soviet embassy, and there were records there showing the Soviet aid to the communists and efforts to undermine the national government, the new nationalist revolutionary government, which was only in Shanghai at the time. So Zhang agreed to or decided on a purge of the communists. So several thousand communists were killed around the country, including in Shanghai. And so it was a bloody purge. But I think anyone who knows and reads about the Communist Party, it's no excuse for Zhang. You could add that to his atrocities, but clearly there would have been an equal atrocity if the Communists could have seized power, as they did when they eventually had power and there was no opposition in the country. Their purges resulted in the deaths of certainly over a million people.
We're coming down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. Maybe we can come back and pick up one of the pieces of the previous caller's question. This is something that deserves more time, perhaps, but maybe among the important associations for Chiang Kai-shek, you'd have to say was the Sung family, the family that he married into, and certainly his wife, Mei Ling Sung, was someone who was very important in maintaining, over the years, American support for Taiwan and for the nationalist Chinese. Perhaps you can talk for a minute or two about the Sungs.
The Sungs were a very wealthy family and very important family in China, and they sided with Sun Yat-sen. And then some of them divided when the split happened between the nationalists and the communists. Sung Qingling, one of the sisters, sided with the communists. But the others became very important actors, and two of the, one Sung, T.V. Sung, and then a brother-in-law of Madam of Sung Mei Ling. They became, alternately, they both served eventually as finance minister, economic minister, and T.V. Sung was as prime minister. He was the major envoy to the United States during the war. They played very prominent roles. The charges are that the Kungs and T.V. Sung were both very corrupt. I think both of them, certainly T.V. Sung, there's certainly a record that he used when he left government for a period in 1936, that he used that period to sort of unethically, knowing changes that were coming in terms of the currency, Chinese currency, to profit, but he was in private business. To the extent that there was any huge amounts of real just graft and thievery, it could have happened, but the evidence is pretty flimsy about that. Mm-hmm. But very briefly, I'd like to say people should also pay attention to what happened in Taiwan, despite the terrible beginning. And what happened in the success of Taiwan under Zhang when he died in 1975, Taiwan had gone through this 15 years of incredible change of economic progress, urbanization, industrialization, increases in health and education. It became an educated, literate, industrialized society in those 15 years. And setting the basis, it also it became one of the most egalitarian societies in the world, quite notably, and still is today. And so it set the basis for a democracy that would take place under his son. So Jiang probably would not have approved of that. But if he could see what happened today, I think he might think it turned out to be the best thing. But certainly, he believed in control. He was not a democratic political leader.
In just about a minute, can you talk about how he is regarded on Taiwan today?
Well, I think most Taiwanese, native Taiwanese, who are 85% or more of the population on Taiwan today, most of them would have a negative view of him. Probably his son would have a majority popular view overall. But some of that has changed. We just saw a year ago, a little more than a year ago, in a new election, the Kuomintang, which had been defeated 8 years before by a basically Taiwanese pro-independence party, it was elected back to power with a very strong majority. The corruption of the previous government was a big factor. But it was quite notable that the Kuomintang leader who led this led them to victory and is now the president of Taiwan, Ma Ying-jeou, that he was a mainlander. His father was a general under Chiang Kai-shek. So I think they have a mixed view of Chiang Kai-shek, that he certainly set the basis for this incredible economic development, one of the economic miracles of East Asia is Taiwan, that the basis was laid under Chiang Kai-shek, but that I think they'll never forgive him the white terrorists that he carried out on Taiwan.
There we will have to leave it. There's much more in the book if you want to read more about the life of Chiang Kai-shek. The book is The Generalissimo, published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, by our guest Jay Taylor. He's a research associate at the Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University. And Mr. Taylor, thank you very much.
Well, it's my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, originally broadcast on the 8th of this month. A lot of our past programs are there. Also, interviews from the Afternoon Magazine, a lot of our local production. It's Will, that's W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, launching their new dinner menu at the end of the month. Tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m., along with lunch on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30, and brunch Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus and wine and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com. WILO thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and the host of that show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be physicist and former MacArthur Fellow Richard Muller. He is the author of Physics for Future Presidents, The Science Behind the Headlines. The book was inspired by a class he teaches at Berkeley that students voted the best class at Berkeley, Physics for Future Presidents. But as a student of Professor Muller put it, a more appropriate title might be Physics for Useful Citizens. We'll talk about physics this afternoon with Richard Muller. Let's take a look now at what's happening in Kansas City and in Chicago with commodity contracts. In Kansas City, the September wheat contract is trading at 5.53 and a quarter, up 6 3/4. December, 5.70, up 6 3/4. Chicago September wheat, 5.16 and a quarter, up 4 3/4. December, 5.43 and a half, up 4 1/2. Corn up today, September, 3.32 3/4, up 12. December, 3.41 1/2, up 13 1/2. March, 3.54 1/4, up 13 3/4. May, 3.63 3/4, up 13 1/2. August, soybeans, 11.27, up 69 1/2. September, 10.28 1/2, up 64 1/2. November, 9.76 3/4, up 60 3/4. January, 9.82, up 62 1/4. August meal, $3.54.80, up $16.30. August oil, $34.89, up $1.82. On to the livestock contracts. Cattle higher today. August live cattle, 84.47 1/2, up 52 1/2. October, 89.55, up 30. August feeder cattle, 102.05, up 2 1/2. September, 102.25, up 20. August lean hogs, 55 even, down $1.75. Outside markets, September crude $66.63, up $3.29. The U.S. dollar $79.33. That